for anybody, but it's a question of under what circumstances, for example, will Lebanon negotiate with Israel? Will it be under the Iranian umbrella in these talks tomorrow, or will it try and forge another path? And which is better? I mean, look, there are some Lebanese who don't care if aliens will negotiate on behalf of Lebanon as long as it can secure a ceasefire.
I wanted to finally ask you about what's happening on the ground. According to the World Health Organization, some of Lebanon's hospitals may run out of life-saving medical supplies within days in an attempt to treat patients wounded by the Israeli airstrikes. This is WHO representative in Lebanon, Dr. Abni Nasir Aboubakar.
There are some shortages, some of those essential chronic medications, the insulin, but also some of the, dialysis supplies. If the current situation and the current demand actually continue, and the current escalation continue, probably the country may be facing a very real risk of critical shortage, including trauma supplies, surgical materials, blood products, chronic medications, and any other further disruption could seriously hinder the ability of providing timely, adequate care for both emergency and ongoing health needs.
Rania Abu Zaid, your final comments on what you think is about to happen, and do you think Iran will insist on including this in the ceasefire, joined by many countries around the world who are saying Lebanon has to be included? Or, as you write in your column, many Lebanese are wondering whether Iran will forsake Hezbollah and allow Lebanon to be pounded.
Very difficult to tell, Amy. That's the honest truth. But, Iran also has its considerations. If it does forsake Hezbollah and goes it alone, well, then, Hezbollah is part of Iran's axis of resistance. There are other allies in the region who will see this and wonder if Iran might forsake it, too. So it's a question of its broader network. There are the Houthis in Yemen. There are various militia groups in Iraq who will be watching very carefully to see what Iran does, if it stands by its ally Hezbollah or if it doesn't. It also has domestic considerations. Iranians have been pounded now for weeks and weeks. They want a reprieve. They don't want to return to war. So the Iranians will be juggling their own sort of conditions as well in terms of what their ultimate stance is with regard to heading to the negotiations tomorrow with or without a ceasefire in Lebanon.
Finally, Rania, I mean, you are there in Beirut. Israel struck central Beirut, southern Beirut, gone beyond the Latani River to the Zahrani River. Some wondering if they'll take over that whole land, about a fifth of Lebanon. But you yourself, are you afraid to walk in the streets?
It depends on what streets, Amy. It depends on where, what part of Lebanon, because that's the thing about Wednesday's attack, is that it shattered the sense that any place is safe, because you just don't know. The neighborhoods that were targeted were very far, for example, from the southern suburbs of Beirut, where Hezbollah has some institutions. Not that that justifies striking a very densely, populated area. The southern suburbs are home to hundreds of thousands of people. But it was anybody's guess. Like, why target a street with a roastery? Why target during rush hour when children were leaving school and civil servants were heading home? So that's the thing. The sense of safety anywhere has been shattered.
Rania Abu Zaid, award-winning Lebanese-Australian journalist. She is based in Beirut. Her latest piece in New York Magazine, just out, we will link to, headlined, "The Iran War is Not Over, Scenes from a Day of Carnage in Beirut." Go to democracynow.org. Coming up, we look at President Trump's threats to pull the U.S. out of NATO after European allies refused to use military force against Iran to keep the Strait of Hormuz open. Will NATO continue to exist? Stay with us. at the Moon by Ahmet Ali Aslan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Europe, where the war in Iran has radically upended transatlantic ties with the United States. On Wednesday, President Trump met with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte at the White House amidst growing threats to pull the U.S. from the military alliance. After the meeting, Trump lashed out on social media, saying in all caps, quote, NATO wasn't there when we needed them, and they won't be there if we need them again. Remember Greenland, that big, poorly run piece of ice, exclamation point three times. The Wall Street Journal reports the Trump administration is considering moving U.S. troops out in NATO member countries, Spain and Germany, as punishment for not supporting the U.S. in its war in Iran. On Thursday, the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte suggested NATO could support the U.S. in the Strait of Hormuz, saying, quote, if NATO can help, obviously NATO is there. He also downplayed European opposition to the war.
When it came time to provide the logistical and other support the United States needed in Iran, some allies were a bit slow, to say the least. In fairness, they were also a bit surprised. To maintain the element of surprise for the initial strikes, President Trump opted not to inform allies ahead of time. And I understand that. But what I see when I look across Europe today is allies providing a massive amount of support, basing, logistics and other measures to ensure the powerful U.S. military succeeds in denying Iran a nuclear weapon and degrading its capacity to export chaos. They have heard and are responding to President Trump's requests.
For more on the Trump administration's strained relationship with Europe, we go to Madrid, Spain, to the heart of Europe's opposition to Trump's war in Iran. We're joined by Natalie Tocci, professor of practice at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Europe. Her latest column for The Guardian headlined, Iran is a turning point for Europe's liberation from Donald Trump. Explain, Professor Tocci.
Well, I mean, of course, Amy, we have seen over the course of over a year a number of repeated threats and betrayals, I would say, from Washington towards Europe, be it over Ukraine, over Greenland, over tariffs, and now, in a sense, weirdly using the excuse of the Iran war, which, frankly speaking, has very little to do with NATO, to lash out again and again. So essentially what we're seeing is, I think, on the one hand, Europeans sort of feeling almost increasingly numb to these threats, right? Not to say that the threats are necessarily empty, but it's almost regardless of what Europeans do, regardless of how much they kiss or do not kiss the ring, these threats tend to come. Because if there's one thing that actually one can say about President Trump is that he's been very consistent in his total disdain for Europe and for NATO. So I think there's Europeans that are beginning increasingly to smell the coffee. And I think, you know, coming alongside this, there's this question of trust within NATO and in the transatlantic alliance, which is being, if not completely broken, then very, very seriously put into question. Because, of course, it's not the first time that the United States does things that Europeans don't particularly agree with. Just think about the war in Iraq back in 2003. And yet there was an element of trust in the relationship, of consultation, of coordination, that Europeans basically felt that there was a social contract, so to speak, with the United States that basically held. Now that social contract, beginning with the trust in the relationship, seems to be broken. And of course, once trust is broken, it's extremely difficult to put the genie back in the bottle.
Tocci, you're in Madrid, Spain. The Spanish prime minister said on X, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's, quote, contempt for life and international law is intolerable. Sanchez has welcomed the Pakistani brokered ceasefire, but said Spain would, quote, not applaud those who set the world on fire just because they turn up with a bucket, in reference to President Trump and the U.S. administration. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, Spain has basically been very consistent, be it on Gaza, on Lebanon, now on Iran. And actually, it has also been very firm on Ukraine as well, despite the fact that obviously it's much further away from the front line with Russia. So we have basically seen the Spanish prime minister take a principled stance when it comes to these various wars and conflict in triangulation with the United States throughout. Now, I think what's interesting about the Spanish case is that, especially if you compare it to other European countries, Sanchez, alongside obviously his, you know, political color to the center left, Spain in general has the both virtue and luck, I guess, of actually not being that dependent on the United States, be it in terms of defense, be it in terms of trade, be it in terms of energy. Spain, of course, is the country that has gone fastest and furthest on the energy transition towards renewable sources. So basically, Sanchez, in a sense, can afford, quote unquote, to be perhaps more principled than other European leaders. But I think what's interesting there is that the mainstream view of other European leaders is increasingly moving away from, in a sense, the sort of sycophantic, you know, kissing of the ring that we've seen of the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, and in a sense, closer to the more principled opposition that we're seeing in Madrid here. Mm.
So in response to Spain's opposition, Germany's opposition to U.S. war on Iran, President Trump is reportedly weighing taking the troops out of Germany and Spain and putting them in more U.S.-friendly countries like Poland and Romania. I'm wondering if you can talk about actually what could happen with NATO. Could it break up? German friend Chancellor Friedrich Merz has warned against a split in NATO when it comes to working with Trump on opening the Strait of Hormuz. From divisions in NATO to it falling apart. What do you see?
Well, you know, I think what's actually quite ironic about these hints and declarations that President Trump has made is that actually, as far as Europeans are concerned, it would make a lot more sense to have more U.S. troop presence in Eastern Europe and actually less U.S. troop presence in Southern Europe. Now, U.S. troop presence in Southern Europe, the basis that we're talking about, are not actually to protect Spain. I mean, Spain is not about to be attacked by Morocco or, I don't know, Italy by Tunisia. They have actually served U.S. security interests in terms of its own power projection in the Middle East. So if President Trump wants to move U.S. troop presence away from Southern Europe and towards Eastern Europe, both Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, I think, will be very happy about it.
Why do you need troops in Europe, East or West?
Well, because, of course, you know, looking east, there is the Russian threat. So obviously there is, in a sense, a threat and a growing threat perception in Europe. And although obviously Europeans are trying to build their own defenses and reducing dependence on the United States, this is obviously not something that can be achieved overnight.
Your piece in The Guardian, you write, Italy's denied U.S. warplanes permission to use an airbase in Sicily. Now, that's very interesting because, of course, it's a right prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, who has supported Trump in the past. That was my additional comment there. Back to your piece. Poland's refused to send Patriot air defense systems to the Middle East, citing the ongoing threat from Russia. France has rejected overflight rights and opposed a U.S.-sponsored resolution at the U.N. Security Council that condemned Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz, calling for its reopening by military means. If you could take it from there, they're also, this is exposing, and I don't know if Trump wanted this, exactly where U.S. troops are all over Europe and what these connections are and what the rights of countries are, for example, to deny airspace. And were you surprised about what Meloni did in Italy?
Well, actually, I wasn't that surprised. And I wasn't that surprised because what is becoming increasingly clear is that closeness to Trump is becoming increasingly politically toxic in Europe. And so even far-right governments like my own in Italy are actually feeling, you know, regardless of what they feel and where their political heart beats, they're finding it increasingly uncomfortable to show support for Donald Trump, given, and here we come back to this breaking of trust, this constant lashing out against Europe. You know, Meloni may, you know, love Trump and adhere to his ideology, but she is still the prime minister of a European country, right? And so this constant lashing out is something that is becoming increasingly uncomfortable. So you see, and this is what, you know, I was trying to get at earlier when saying that, okay, fine, you know, Spain started off this way, but you see a number of other European countries, from Poland to Germany to Italy to France, and the United Kingdom, gradually shifting, in a sense, towards, in a sense, a more Sanchez-like position, even if they had started off wanting to embrace Trump. But Trump is making it increasingly difficult for them to embrace him.
Natalie Tocci, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of practice, Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, Europe, and a senior fellow at Bocconi University's Institute for European Policymaking, speaking to us from Madrid, Spain, also a Guardian Europe columnist. We'll link to your new piece, Iran's a Turning Point for Europe's Liberation, from Donald Trump. Go to democracynow.org. Coming up, voters in Hungary head to the polls on Sunday. Well, why was Vice President J.D. Vance there this week before he now heads to Pakistan? Could the election mark the end of Viktor Orban's rule? Stay with us. Musician Kaidav Arbi, Nightingale of the North, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the one country in Europe where the transatlantic relationship has only gotten stronger under the Trump administration, Hungary. But that relationship is about to be tested because as Hungary goes to the polls Sunday, far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban is facing his biggest challenge in 16 years— Polls show the center-right party, led by Péter Magyar, with a significant lead over Orbán's party in the days before Hungary's parliamentary election. The latest polls show Orbán's party has the support of 39% of decided voters, 52% back his opponent's party. 25% of voters said they're undecided. Orbán's been prime minister of Hungary since 2010, making him the European Union's longest-serving leader. Earlier today, he accused his political opponents of trying to seize power in a video message posted to social media.
Our opponents will stop at nothing to seize power. They are colluding with foreign secret services, threatening our followers with violence, and calling out election fraud with fabricated accusations even before the election. They are organizing demonstrations and chaos even before your votes have been counted. Let us speak clearly. This is an organized attempt to question the decisions of the Hungarian people through chaos, pressure, and international discredit.
On Tuesday, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance traveled to Budapest, where he appeared alongside Prime Minister Orban and openly campaigned for his re-election.
Will you stand against the bureaucrats in Brussels? Will you stand for sovereignty and democracy? Will you stand for Western civilization? Will you stand for freedom, for truth, and for the God of our fathers? Then, my friends, go to the polls in the weekend. Stand with Viktor Orban.
For more, we're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by Kim Lane Shepley. She's professor of sociology and international affairs in the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Her research examines the rise and fall of constitutional government with a focus on Hungary. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why is Hungary so critical, and what is the U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance doing there? He's now headed off to Pakistan to lead the negotiations with Iran.
Yeah, so yes, this election is really crucial, not just for Hungary, but for the international sort of right wing. Viktor Orban has controlled Hungary for 16 years. He's become a dictator, though he doesn't like to call himself that. It's crucial to have a state in Europe with the resources of a state backing sort of the undermining of the European Union, backing the kind of policies that Donald Trump has had. So it's not surprising that the Trump administration has been strongly backing Orban. J.D. Vance's visit this week was the second visit by a high-level Trump administration official. Remember that Marco Rubio went to Budapest right after the Munich Security Conference. So there's been a lot of American signaling that the U.S. would really love to have Viktor Orban be reelected. The problem is the Hungarian people don't seem to agree.
This is Hungarian Prime Minister Orban speaking to reporters during a joint news conference with Vice President J.D. Vance this week.
Vice President, my dear friend, Vice President, it has been 35 years since a Vice President last visited Hungary, and we have not had such a high-ranking guest from the United States for 20 years. 20 years is a long time between friends. With the election of President Trump, a golden age has dawned in our relations. As we have just looked at 2025, we see it was a year of records in economic cooperation.
So that's Prime Minister Orban, who is standing next to J.D. Vance at this joint news conference. Why is Hungary, led by Orban, so important for Europe right now, particularly the right in Europe? And what would it mean if he loses? And why would J.D. Vance care about that?
Yeah, so Viktor Orban, first of all, is so far behind in the polls that even his rigged election system will probably not save him this time. And it's causing some panic in the right wing in Europe, because once Orban consolidated power in Hungary, he then spent a huge amount of Hungarian money, we think up to 1% of total Hungarian GDP, on an effort to influence and to build a far-right network across Europe. So in the last European elections, for example, Orban's Fidesz political party was the primary advertiser on behalf of far-right parties across Europe. And as you know, those European elections tilted quite heavily in favor of the far-right. Orban came out of those elections not only with a substantial victory in Hungary, but he was actually able to cobble together the third largest party in the European Parliament, which has really tilted European policy in favor of the right. So he's the kingmaker in Europe in terms of building far-right cohesion, and the Trump administration has been echoing Orban's language. In fact, if you look at the national security strategy that the U.S. released back in the fall, it could almost have been written by Orban. The language is exactly the same. And the code word for the far right now is the Patriots in Europe, because the Patriots is the name of Orban's European-wide political party.
I wanted to ask you about a very interesting figure in the Trump administration. That's Sebastian Gorka, Trump's deputy assistant to the president, senior director for counterterrorism. He advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary while he served as a Hungarian politician. Gorka's Hungarian.
Yeah, so Gorka's actually a complicated figure. He was raised in Britain by far-right parents. And in fact, the far-right organization that he supported is actually not neo-Nazi, but Nazi. His father was a member of a Nazi-aligned group when the Nazis were actually dominating Europe. When Gorka showed up at Trump's first inauguration, he wore not only the insignia, but also the uniform of the original Nazi paramilitary organization. After that was discovered, he then got marginalized. He got kicked out of the White House. But he's been still aligned with Trump forces. So now Gorka has come back as counterterrorism director in the White House. But, you know, Gorka has this interesting history in Hungary. After the Berlin Wall came down, he moved from Britain to Hungary. He worked in the Hungarian defense establishment, and he got to know the Hungarian government very well. He then briefly founded a rival political party to Orban's political party when Orban was out of power in the 2000s. And then when there was a kind of discussion between, shall we say, Gorka and Orban, Gorka agreed to dissolve his party, and the people from Gorka's political party went straight into Orban's party, where they still are now. Okay, so Gorka has direct personal ties with Orban. So it's not surprising. And Gorka speaks Hungarian, et cetera. So he's the point person in the White House who has the direct contacts with the Orban team.
Thursday's New York Times had an interesting story headlined, U.S. pushes allies to chase a new terrorism target, the far left. It's a push to designate far-left and anti-fascist groups overseas as terrorist organizations and pressure those countries to investigate the groups and find links between left-wing groups abroad and Americans. The leaders of this initiative, and I'm reading from the Times right now, the leaders of this initiative, according to the piece, include Sebastian Gorka. Your final comments.
Yes. Yeah, so Gorka heads counterterrorism, so that's the weapon he's going to use. And, of course, after 9/11, there's a huge counterterrorism network and a huge set of counterterrorism resources available for going after enemies of different kinds. And what Trump is trying to do and what Orban has already done in Hungary is to start labeling, and I wouldn't even call it the far left, right? It's the entire left, as the opposition to these far-right groups. And they've, so far, they've been using media denigration, making fun of them, trying to establish and argue for networks that aren't there. But this move to start to label any kind of group that these governments don't like, that these patriot groups in Europe don't like, as part of a far-left network is, first of all, false, that the network doesn't exist. But second of all, it's a way of trying to weaponize these resources that governments have against the left so as to get them out of the way so the right has a better chance of coming to power in European governments. And yes, the U.S. is entirely behind this. The U.S. is also talking about setting up, they've destroyed Voice of America and the other kind of global networks the U.S. used to have, but now they're talking about actually building in Europe a kind of, you know, Fox News for Europe in order to, again, give the far right a push. So this is all playing out on the political field. Orban is central to this because right now he controls the state and state resources. But after Sunday, you know, I think he's actually going to be out of power, and then we'll see.
Kim Lane Shepley, I want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government with a focus on Hungary. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to David Prude, and an early happy birthday to Anna Osbeck, Diego Ramos, and Maria Inez Taracena. I'll be at the IFC Center here in New York City this weekend, all through tonight and tomorrow morning at 10:30, as well as through the afternoon and evening and Sunday for the opening, the theatrical release of Steal the Story, Please, about the 30 years of Democracy Now. I'll be there with the directors of the film, T. Lesson and Carl Diehl, and many others. You can check it all out at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for jobs. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.